Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about a special public conversation I'm hosting, and you're invited to join me and several of Charlotte's African-American leaders for Building an Inclusive City. That's on February 21st, 7 p.m. at Spirit Square. We'll be talking with Charlotte's mayor, police chief, city manager, and district attorney. Details and free registration at WFAE.org, and we hope to see you there.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. In our political environment, the role of the judiciary has become more than just a referee calling balls and strikes. Some would argue that the courts have become just as politicized as the elected branches of government, with the level of trust in our judiciary coming under scrutiny by all sides. And while legislatures are seen as the lawmakers and executives serve to implement the laws, the courts have become more than umpires, with major policy decisions decided by both lawyers and judges within our legal system. But as the country has grappled with police shootings, protests against law enforcement, and called into question the independence of the judiciary, one of the leading voices on behalf of the legal community joins us for the hour. Hillary Bass serves as the president of the American Bar Association, and she is in town today to speak to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte, where she will share her perspective on international business, domestic and foreign policy, and the role of the ABA in global judicial affairs and at home under the Trump administration. She is one of the nation's highest profile female attorneys and has represented clients including Microsoft, Hilton Hotels, and the government of Brazil, as well as foster kids, on pro bono cases. She is co-president of the firm Greenberg Traurig, a firm with 38 offices worldwide and approximately 2,000 lawyers. And we welcome Hillary Bass to Charlotte and to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. You can join our conversation as well via email, charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Twitter, @charlottetalks, or you can watch us on Facebook Live, being streamed right now. And unfortunately, I want to start with yesterday's tragic news. Out of Florida, it has once again brought the spotlight again on the issue of guns in our society. And while we're still in the preliminary stages of trying to understand yesterday's mass shooting at the Florida school, but after the mass shooting in Las Vegas, and I have to remind folks, it was only 5 months ago, the American Bar Association issued the following statement, and I want to read it. In the aftermath of yet another tragic mass shooting in America, more than sympathy is needed. The ABA will rededicate its efforts to facilitate changes to stop senseless gun deaths. Legal experts from all backgrounds agree that this can be done through sensible regulations, legislation, and widespread education that can protect the safety of individuals and their constitutional rights. And the ABA is working with a broad coalition of medical societies and health organizations to address gun violence as a critical public health problem. Effective and constitutional solutions exist. It is past time to work together to enact them. I presume that the ABA would have similar feelings this morning about the Florida shooting. So I want to start by asking, what do you see as the ways to facilitate change to stop senseless gun deaths?
Well, obviously, we know that there is much that we could be done with legislation. And this is something quite personal to me because this high school is less than an hour from my home.
Really?
And so in watching this news since last night, I am sure that I know people who will be personally affected by this violence. When you see the statistics of the tens of thousands of people every year in our country that are the victims of gun violence, we must do better to stop this. It's both a problem of having semi-automatic weapons, as well as a mental health crisis, because we have many people who are in prison now, for example, that really should not be there, but for the fact that there's no place else to put people with mental health issues. So the ABA has been working very, very hard to both lobby Congress and to work in a community-based effort to make people aware of the fact that the Second Amendment does not prevent reasonable restrictions on the sale and distribution of guns. And we have lots of case law from the courts that support that.
Why do you think – well, first off, what kind of legislation could be enacted if setting aside the intense politicalization of this particular issue, what kind of pieces of legislation should be considered that maybe would have addressed this issue that occurred yesterday?
Well, there are two that come to mind that the ABA has supported. One is restrictions on semi-automatic weapons. I don't think anyone can suggest that when we created the Second Amendment, when our constitutional fathers created the Second Amendment, that they had this in mind. And we know that the American public is very supportive of appropriate restrictions on semi-automatic weapons. There's only one purpose for semi-automatic weapons, and that's to kill people. It's not for hunting. It's not for self-protection in one's home. It is for people who have mental health issues who use them to create terror. So that's one key point. And the second, of course, is background checks. We make it tougher to walk on a plane than to buy a gun. And we know that Congress recently refused to act to prevent people who are on the terror watch list from getting guns. So it would seem that there are some basic background checks and the elimination of loopholes to background checks that could make huge progress in this area.
So what? So just for clarification, if I were to go out and after the show go seek to buy a gun, what do I have to go through in terms of making a legal purchase of a gun at this point in time?
Well, it's different state by state. So we know that some states have really imposed quite restrictive background checks that ensure that you haven't had a history of domestic violence, you haven't had a history of mental health problems. But in many states, those restrictions don't exist. And we also know that there are still huge loopholes through gun shows and internet purchases. So if somebody can go on the internet and buy a semi-automatic weapon, what kind of background check is being done to ensure that they are not someone who has a history of gun violence in their past?
Okay. So in terms of being a constitutional solution, certainly there have been some Supreme Court cases that have dealt with it. What has been the rationale of putting forward these restrictions and the concern by Second Amendment advocates in terms of, you know, if you start down one venue of restrictions, is that the slippery slope? Is there something to that argument that those who would say restrict one type of gun, you're going to go after other types of guns? Or how have the courts dealt with?
I don't believe that's true. I mean, we have restrictions on all kinds of things in our society. Look at alcohol. There are restrictions as to age, as to location, as to how it can be advertised. That doesn't prevent us from being able to enjoy in appropriate locations and settings drinking alcohol. There's no basis for the suggestion that imposing reasonable restrictions is going to end up violating the Second Amendment. The courts haven't supported that concept. And as best I can tell, we're talking about the NRA and gun manufacturers really being the proponents of those concepts.
So the NRA certainly is one of the leading interest group lobbying, particularly when it comes to campaign fundraising. They certainly support a lot of politicians, particularly those of the Republican Party. What organization is out there? Is the ABA an organization that is working on the opposite side to try and get some kind of reasonable restrictions on gun regulations?
Well, the ABA is a nonpartisan organization of 400,000 lawyers. It is voluntary in nature, and typically we do lobby on a number of different priorities. But typically with something like this, we would partner with other organizations whose primary focus is gun violence and the restriction on gun violence.
Okay. You mentioned that it's also a critical public health problem. And certainly the legal community deals with health issues on a daily basis. How does the ABA see working with medical organizations, federal agencies, to address this kind of a situation?
Well, actually, we have a commission on gun violence. Mm-hmm. And what we have done is worked with medical physicians in various communities to jointly present the issue of gun violence as one that is medical and legal in nature.
Okay. This, it seems like, you know, particularly in the past couple of years, the number of mass shootings has escalated. It continues to draw outrage and calls of sympathy and prayers and thoughts, and then truly nothing happens. Will this event be the catalyst to perhaps make the change, or are we going to be revisiting this again in 6 months, do you think?
Well, I hope it will be, but it's clear to me anyway on a personal level that what we've done in the past has not been effective. If people really care about this issue, they're going to have to be as laser focused on voting out of office legislatures who refuse to enact appropriate restrictions on gun acquisition as those who are against it are laser focused on threatening to throw out of office anyone who votes in favor. If it is in fact correct, as I continue to see in these surveys, that 95% of the American public believes that appropriate restrictions on guns should be enacted, then it seems to me that if there is appropriate community support to vote out of office those legislatures who refuse to pass that legislation, that we could really make a difference.
Okay. Guns certainly are one of the key challenges in this society that we're in, and you've been quite vocal about the role that lawyers play in protecting our democracy from its challenges. What do you see as some of the other challenges to our democratic republic in today's society?
Well, it's interesting because in your opening, you talked about the independence of the judiciary. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually quite confident in the independence of the judiciary. It has to be guarded. It has to be protected. And the American Bar Association spends a lot of time, and I personally speak out on the topic quite a bit. The judiciary is independent in their rulings. What we have is an effort to undermine their independence by criticizing them inappropriately.
Where's that undermining coming from, do you think?
Well, certainly it's coming from our current administration. And I have spoken out on multiple occasions to try and remind people the basic concepts of separation of powers. We have three separate but equal branches of government. And so, for example, I spoke out recently when the president criticized the judiciary for not appropriately deferring to the prerogatives of the executive. And I reminded everyone that our federal judges take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not to defer to the executive. That's not their role. They have a separate and independent role in our constitutional democracy, and that is to review the matters that are before them and to rule in a way that is appropriate under the Constitution. And it doesn't matter whether it's Congress or the executive that is acting inappropriately. Their role is to determine what the Constitution requires.
Okay. So the certainly the three branches of government have been overlapping, you know, as you describe, pretty frequently. And it's been occurring at both the state and the federal level. Here in North Carolina, for example, the governor and the legislature have been to court battling each other over the issue of separation of power, who has authority over different programs. And as you mentioned, of course, President Trump's early executive actions on refugees and immigrants have run into obstacles through the judiciary and through judicial rulings. What are your observations in terms of the judicial branch being referred to, and I spoke about this in the intro, the referee to the other branches?
Well, in some ways, I think that's an accurate description.
Okay.
What I find so interesting is...
We'll pick up after that, sure. after the break. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're speaking to the American Bar Association's president, Hillary Bass, who is here in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. And before the break, we were talking about the role in terms of the courts being the referee in this polarized political environment. Can we truly say that referees are neutral observers of our legal system and the conflicts that come before them, whether it's from the governor's office, from the legislature, from the president? Do judges really shed the partisan labels that oftentimes we as human beings come with?
I think the concept of lifetime appointments, which is what our constitutional framers provided for our judges, was an effort to insulate them from the political challenges of the day. So our federal court are appointed, and they never have to run for office. And so they have only one job, and that is to evaluate what's before them independently, objectively, and within the framework of what the constitutional prerogatives require. So there was a real effort by our constitutional founders to ensure that they are separated from the day-to-day politics. That being said, we know people bring to whatever decision they make their ideology, their background, and it's one of the reasons why it's so important to have a diverse judiciary, so that you ensure that all the different views of the local community are represented by the courts.
This certainly seems like this is a major thrust of your presidency of the ABA. Is this something that's personal to you, or is this a role that the ABA president has taken in the past and you feel now is a continuation of speaking out about the judiciary?
We have always spoken out on the judiciary. The protection of the rule of law is one of our four main goals as an organization. Obviously, in the current environment, there's been more necessity to come and speak out to attempt to protect the judiciary and stand up for them when they're being inappropriately criticized.
Well, I want to speak a little bit about that because we've seen here in North Carolina at the state level legislative pushes to rein in the courts, and particularly with proposals to alter judicial elections and perhaps even the makeup of the judicial branch. Recently, after Pennsylvania's Supreme Court ruled their congressional districts were unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering, some legislators in Pennsylvania called for the impeachment of some of the members of the state's highest court. Do you consider these actions to be a breach of the separation of powers, or are checks and balances a two-way street when it comes to the courts as well?
Well, checks and balances are a two-way street, but the judiciary has a unique function, and that is that they are supposed to objectively evaluate legislation and issues that come before it. Throughout our constitutional democracy, we have a history of lots of efforts to go against the judiciary when they issue opinions that the reigning politicians are unhappy with. Thankfully, most of those efforts are ineffective. And our perspective from the American Bar Association is that an independent judiciary is critical to the rule of law. People have to have confidence that judges are able to speak their mind through their opinions and rule the way they believe it's appropriate and not be fearful of political backlash when they do that.
Okay. You quoted James Madison once as saying that checks and balances provide a framework for freedom, but the framework isn't self-executing. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's very interesting. I think a lot of people think more highly of lawyers in the last year than many times in the recent past. Why is that? Because I think there's a recognition that but for lawyers, who was going to stand in airports to offer pro bono assistance to immigrants coming in the crosshairs of executive orders? The state attorney generals that have run into court to stop executive orders that they believe are unconstitutional. The democracy only works because there are lawyers who are there to protect it. And oftentimes that means running into the court to say this action is outside the boundaries of what our Constitution contemplates.
Okay. You recently have weighed in on a number of controversial issues, most recently the Independent Counsel reviewing the investigation into Russia's influence in the 2016 election. Specifically, what do you view as kind of the intimidating tactics to thwart this investigation? How do you see that playing out as a concern for the rule of law in the country?
Well, I think the role of the special counsel is somewhat unique in that they are appointed, they're given a task to independently review something that's happening in our government, and then to report back. any effort to undermine that undermines our rule of law. We had the same thing with Watergate. And as you recall, what actually brought the administration, the Nixon administration, down was not the underlying act so much as the efforts of the president to undermine the work of the special counsel. The rule of law only works if we can ensure our constituents that there is not corruption in the system. When someone is appointed to investigate that corruption, they must be allowed to do their job. And any effort to undermine that through intimidation or threats undermines the rule of law.
Okay. One, certainly President Trump has looked at that as a concern for his administration. But in another area, President Trump is looking to reshape the courts with judicial appointments, which by all accounts have been fairly swift in comparison to others. The pace of appointments in his first year was the fastest since Nixon. And these appointments are taking the federal courts and the appellate courts in a distinctly conservative direction. Regardless of the party in power, do you worry about the politicalization of the courts? And could the judicial branch be moving towards a more polarized environment, just like in the other branches?
I certainly hope not. The ABA has an important role to play in that we do the peer review for each federal nominee. Prior to Trump, we did that pre-nomination. Mm-hmm. So, for example, for Obama, we would find out in advance who he was thinking about appointing. We would do the due diligence, issue a report as to qualified, not qualified, or well qualified. And in certain cases, he pulled the nominee. President Trump chose to throw us out of that process. Thankfully, the Judiciary Committee still believes that our reports are very valuable, so we continue that effort. But we're looking to ensure that the nominees that are put before Judiciary are of the highest quality and have appropriate temperament. But it is a nonpartisan review. We do not get into the ideology or the political background of the candidates.
But I want to follow up with this. Some Republicans would contend that the ABA has become politically involved in it. Some Republicans would criticize the organization as being liberal in terms of the evaluations of judicial nominees. At a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing last fall, Republicans criticized the ABA for the ratings of Trump nominees. What's your response in terms of the questioning of the ABA's neutrality? Do you feel that those claims are inappropriate or unfair when you are speaking out against the president or some of his nominees?
I think the record speaks for itself. We have done 60 nominees reports thus far since the Trump administration has come in. Out of those 60 nominees, we have found 4 unqualified.
How do you go about making that determination?
We reach out to one of the ones that we found to be unqualified. We'd contacted more than 200 people, everybody who'd ever been in court with that individual, people who were the judges before whom that individual practiced, their advocates, their adversaries. And we have an interview process where we confidentially ask them to talk broadly about that candidate. What I would say to the people that criticize us as being supposedly too left-wing, out of the 60 candidates that we've reviewed, we only found 4 unqualified. And to your point, we all know that these candidates come from, for the most part, a very strongly conservative bent. I question the people who are criticizing us about how it was we found 56 of these people qualified. I think the record speaks for itself.
Okay. Despite the president's attacks on the judiciary, or maybe because of it, public trust in the judicial system seems to be on the rise, at least according to a Gallup poll last fall. More Americans were trustful of the judiciary, 68% in 2017, while fewer Americans were trustful of the executive branch. Why do you think the worthiness, the trust in our court system has tended to tick up in the past few years?
Well, I can only anecdotally speculate, but it would seem to me that one of the reasons that the court system continues to be supported by the public trust is because they are unwavering. They are not affected by the criticism of the administration. They are not affected when someone suggests that because they have an ethnic background that means it's going to affect their ruling one way or the other. They are steadfast. They take their oath to the Constitution.
Okay. Improving that trust in the judicial system is another area. Certainly that has been a focus for you in your presidency. It's a conversation that communities from Charlotte here to Ferguson, Missouri have been having about after incidents of racial unrest. A lot of those conversations have been about the role of law enforcement. What role do lawyers have as members of the judicial system to shape that public trust or potential distrust?
Well, I think there's a lot that we can do. One of the major focuses this year in my initiatives is to focus on people's confidence in the justice system. And that goes into two areas. One is the number of poor people we are putting in jail. We have a criminalization of poverty going on in our country, and people don't even realize it. People say, oh, well, we don't have debtors' prisons. Well, they don't think we do, but in fact, unfortunately, that's not the case. We have a bail system, for example, where for the most part, people are given bail without an appropriate evaluation of whether or not there's any ability to pay, whether they really pose a threat to the community, and whether or not there is any likelihood of them not showing up in court. And so what we have done is arrested a lot of young people, oftentimes black and brown, for minor infractions. And whereas anybody with means would be able to quickly bail out and the dispute would be resolved without jail time, these people end up in jail, oftentimes for lengthy periods of time. We do the same thing with fees and fines. Somebody, for example, has a taillight missing on their car. They may have a ticket imposed. That ticket in and of itself would not result in jail time, but their failure to pay the ticket may oftentimes result in an infraction that does result in jail time. So people oftentimes, because of their inability to pay a fee or fine, find themselves in jail for a civil infraction. If people don't believe the courthouses are open to them in a fair way, that's not going to help them have trust in our justice system.
So what kind of reforms, particularly on the bail system, would the ABA be recommending to address that concern?
And every judge should be assessing whether or not the individual before them really is a threat to the community or is a threat for non-appearance. And do they have the ability to post bail? If the answers to all of those questions are they do not pose any threat, they are going to show up, and no, they don't have the ability to post bail, why should they end up in jail when somebody else has a home that they can pledge and therefore they go out scot-free?
Okay. How can lawyers, judges in particular, work with other arms of law enforcement, particularly those police officers, to improve the public confidence in the legal system?
One thing we've worked very hard over the last couple of years is focusing on implicit bias in the justice system. We know we all have implicit bias.
What do you mean by implicit bias?
Implicit bias is even when you believe that you are either gender neutral or race neutral in your behavior, what we know from studies is that deep inside we have some inherent biases that we don't even realize that we have. And oftentimes those come out in our behavior. In the issue of gender, it's the way we expect women to behave in the workplace. In the course of implicit bias in the justice system, oftentimes it's the way police react to a young black man or a young brown man. And so we've focused quite a bit on trying to help train the police and the prosecutors as to what implicit bias is and how we can try and learn that we each of us have it and how to overcome it.
How might be a tactic that somebody would seek to try and overcome that implicit bias?
Well, so for example, we've done studies with judges and shown them how to overcome their implicit bias. And oftentimes it's a question of stopping and asking oneself, am I being affected in my decision making, in my sentencing, by virtue of the fact that this is a young black man versus a white, that it happens to be someone who's Islamic in front of me rather than non-Islamic. We know from lots of studies that we all have those biases. And so the first most important thing is to recognize you have it. And then secondly, try and alter your behavior to ensure that your decision-making is not being influenced by it.
Okay. Certainly, fact-checking has been in vogue since Donald Trump's arrival on the political scene, and it's something that you have started at the American Bar Association after you recently took the helm. What is the ABA in terms of its fact-checking operations, and how do you get through to people who simply don't care what the facts are nowadays?
Well, there are going to be those, but thankfully we have many people who would like to know what the real facts are, but don't have confidence that what they're reading on the internet or hearing on television really are the facts. So we started ABA Legal Fact Check in August, and we post online specific descriptions of what the legal facts are behind a particular issue in the public discourse. So, for example, our president, when he was a candidate, suggested that anybody who burned an American flag should have their citizenship revoked. We immediately posted in a nonpartisan way that in 1978, the Supreme Court had ruled that burning of an American flag is a right of expression under the First Amendment, protected from criminal penalty. Again, it's a nonpartisan statement, but if the law has been established and there are politicians or people in the media who are suggesting that the law is other than what it is, the American Bar Association is going to stand up and write clearly what the law is so that people know they have a reliable source for it.
Okay. Peggy emails, besides the rightward tilt of President Trump's judicial nominees, I'm concerned about the lack of diversity. 80 of 87 are white, one African American, one Hispanic, and five Asians. Is that something that is concerning to the ABA?
It is concerning to the ABA, and I recently put out a statement about the choices for U.S. attorney, which were similarly white and male. We know that people are affected by who they are in their decision-making, and that means it's critically important that whether it's prosecutors and the U.S. attorney's diversity or judges and the judiciary's diversity, it is critical that for us to have trust in our justice system, those individuals must have the diversity that are reflective of their community. So it's a very concerning issue.
Okay. We're talking with Hillary Bass, who is the president of the American Bar Association, who's speaking later today here in Charlotte on the role of the courts and the legal profession. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. And we're talking with Hillary Bass, the president of the American Bar Association, who's going to be speaking later today at the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. We've been talking about the role of the courts and the judiciary and the challenges that are posed in terms of how the courts interact within our society. Are there other major areas that you want your presidency of the ABA to address and confront when it comes to the challenges in our society with the role of the law and the courts?
Well, there's one in particular that I have a personal interest in, and that is women in the law.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because what we know is that for the last 30 years, women have been attending law school and getting their first post-law school job at about the same rate as men. But women continue to leave the profession in droves.
Why is
so
that?
So we start off 50-50, and by the age of 50, we're half gone. Well, we have a lot of anecdotal evidence to show why that's happening, but we know that anecdote doesn't create change. Data does. So what we're doing this year is doing a longitudinal study with focus groups and e-surveys to talk to women who have chosen to stay and women who have chosen to leave, and to question them as to what your legal employer might have been able to do differently to have incentivized you to stay in the law. Preliminarily, we know that there are a number of things that affect women's decisions. One is what's called success fatigue, the perception among women that they always have to work just a little bit harder to get the same level of recognition. Implicit bias. There is a reason why women continue to get paid 80 cents on the dollar, and we believe it has a lot to do with implicit bias. The glass ceiling, which has certainly moved up, so it's relatively easy for women to get that first job. Many women are partners. Many women can even make it higher up the level. But we know that we still have 19% equity partners are women. Less than 5% of managing partners are women. So we still have a long way to go. And the assumption that this was just a question of timing, that as women worked up the pipeline, they would achieve the same level of success, sadly, we know that's not the case. And as problematic as the statistics are for women lawyers, they're even more problematic for diverse lawyers. So we really have to do some self-reflection. What is it that makes our profession so inhospitable to women and diverse attorneys? And we have to change, because there's a recognition that it's very important for our profession to be reflective of the diversity in our communities.
Why did you choose to become a lawyer?
I thought being a lawyer was the best way to create societal change. And so I was compelled to be a lawyer initially with the idea that I would go into politics. But I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I was in a community that I didn't think would necessarily support my political views.
Okay. Your presidency certainly coincides with the Me Too movement that has really caught fire across the country, and the focus of the experiences of women in the workplace. In October, the American Law Review reported on harassment in the legal profession and cited research from Stanford and Southern Methodist University suggesting harassment in the legal profession is more pervasive than one might expect. What's your sense of the level of harassment in the legal profession?
Well, I'm actually one of those that's been quite surprised by some of the recent studies we've seen, one by the Florida Bar, one by the California Bar, both reflecting that women express very high percentages, either 30 to 40% of women who have experienced some form of harassment or bullying within the workplace. One of the things we did just last week at the American Bar Association mid-year meeting was to pass a resolution that contained some basic best practices for law firms and other employers. People want to address this problem. Legal employers want to address this problem. Many people question, how do we do it? How do we fix this? And so we're trying to get very specific to say, do you have an anonymous hotline so that somebody who is a subject of harassment can feel comfortable knowing they can complain to somebody? Do we really set a policy from the very top of the employer to ensure that everybody knows it's not just an HR policy, but there's a real commitment from the top to enforce it? How do we handle the claims once they're made? Is there retribution against the person who's made the complaint? And are there real sanctions against the harasser? Lots of experiences where people complain, there's an investigation, and there's some sanction imposed, but oftentimes it's a slap on the wrist because the person involved is very important to the organization. That's not a challenge just to legal employers,
right,
but to employers in general.
Do you think after this study that the ABA is doing, what will be the next step? You certainly represent the association that is one of the largest in terms of the legal community. What will come about, do you think, or what should be the next steps after studying this?
Our plan is, once we go through the study, is to go to our House of Delegates, which is basically our Congress, with very specific proposals as to policy. What should law employers do differently to try and help address this problem?
Okay. Women have been outnumbering men in law school enrollment in 2016. That marked the first time that women outnumbered men in law school. Why are they, do you think, still underrepresented in terms of the hiring process?
Well, interestingly, it's not so much at that first job, but it's as they go up the chain. That's when women choose to leave. And this, we used to assume that they were leaving in the first 5 to 10 years of practice when they started having children and they decided they needed more balance in their lives. But what we now know is those women oftentimes come back, make partner, are quite successful in their career, and yet they're still choosing to leave. And for us to be losing this tremendous resource at the height of their career, when they're of real value both to their clients and their firms, that's the question that we're trying to address.
Okay.
How do we ensure those women stay in the profession?
Okay. Another area that you have been focused on in your presidency so far is the future of law schools. And it's something certainly Charlotte has paid attention to over the past 2 years. We saw the collapse of the Charlotte School of Law after the ABA put the school on probation. And an American Bar Association Journal headline about the school said it was not the only one facing an uncertain future. What is the state of law schools and the legal education in our country at this point in time?
Well, first I should explain that the Department of Education has contracted with the Council of the Section of Legal Education to be the accreditor of law schools. That council is really independent from the rest of the ABA per the agreement with the Department of Education, so we do not get directly involved in their decisions. That being said, one of my focuses this year is on the future of American law schools, because what we know is that the practice of law is changing radically. And are our law schools keeping up? Are we providing people in law school today with the skills they're going to need to practice in 2050? And then secondly, the lack of alignment between what we're teaching in law schools and what we're testing. Bar exams look very similar to what they have for 50 years. And yet what we're expecting our lawyers to be capable of doing when they graduate law school is very different from that. So we are looking at all these issues to ensure that we are doing the best we can to educate our future lawyers.
Okay. We have a number of folks who have submitted comments. Mike on Facebook asks the question, what should North Carolina voters look for in recent legislative efforts to change how we elect our judiciary? Has the ABA taken a stand on state judges and how they should be appointed to their positions?
Yes. We've long been a proponent for the retention of judges, meaning not to have judges elected. Why? Because we believe that when judges are elected, it makes them much more subject to the political issues of the day and undermines the independence that they should have in making their decisions. So we've long supported a concept where there is a slate of nominees that is vetted by the local bar association and public citizens and then provided to the governor. So the governor selects from that limited group rather than subjecting everyone to an election. And then thereafter, every 3 or 5 or 7 years, there's a retention election. So if these people have not behaved appropriately or met their obligations as a judge, the community has the ability to vote them out.
Okay. Dan emailed, why is there a disparity in degree of difference in probable cause? Police say probable cause is anything they believe, and the courts say probable cause has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. The court system needs the exact same degree of probable cause for police, magistrate, judges, and juries.
Well, I think there's a recognition that police on the street are not in a position to evaluate evidence in the same way that a jury is after the fact. Mm. So police are making quick decisions based on the evidence that they see, oftentimes in problematic circumstances where they have to make instantaneous decisions. A jury has the luxury of being fed all the evidence after a particular incident. And so the standard for what's required to hold somebody liable for a crime is obviously different for the preliminary probable cause that's required to arrest somebody, at least preliminarily.
You have, as I mentioned earlier in the intro, you have represented the government of Brazil. You have done some international work as well. In comparison to the United States and other countries and their judicial systems, we oftentimes see other nations attacking their judicial systems. There is certainly a rise of authoritarianism occurring in Eastern Europe. In comparison to what we have, what are the concerns about the international judicial system? And is that something that Americans should be concerned about here at home?
Well, it's not coincidence that when you look at those authoritarian regimes, very often the first thing that people go after in their effort to coordinate and consolidate power is the judiciary. Whether it's Hungary or Poland, the judiciary typically has a target on their back.
Why is that?
Because judiciaries are there to control the power grabs of the other branches of government. And so if you undermine the authority of the judiciary to do their job, it makes it much easier for someone who has an authoritarian bent to improperly utilize power. I do think the American public needs to be laser focused on protecting their judiciary, because sadly, if we were to have an instance in our country where someone was behaving in a way that was against our Constitution, the first thing they would try and do is undermine people's public trust in the judiciary, because that's where that we would look for the protection against right. that expression of authority.
Do you get a sense that the public understands our judicial system and how it works?
I think we have a challenge across our country with the lack of civics education. Every year we promote Law Day, and this year my focus for Law Day is separation of powers, because I do think that our population as a whole needs to have a better understanding of the fact that we have three branches of government. Mm-hmm. They were all designed to be separate but equal and to have equal power. That's something that many people don't really understand, and I think the lack of civics education in our middle schools and high schools really is helping to undermine that understanding of the way our democracy works.
Do you think, though, that it's also part of the nature of the judiciary? I mean, we see Congress in action, and we see the president in action so much, and they tend to dominate the headlines and the news coming out of it. The courts tend to be, for lack of a better term, insular. They tend, unless you're in the courtroom or unless you're involved in the legal profession, you don't see a whole lot of the activity until a major announcement comes out or a major decision.
Well, and it's designed that way. Our judges are prevented by judicial ethics codes from talking about decisions they're about to make, from talking openly about evidence that is before them in the courtroom. So in many ways, they've got one arm tied behind their back. They really can't talk about what's going on. So that's why it's so important for lawyers and organizations like the American Bar Association to come to their defense, because they're really prevented by their own ethics codes from doing it themselves.
What have you seen as the major changes in the legal profession over your career so far? What has surprised you in terms of being a lawyer and now representing over 400,000 lawyers?
Well, I would say that one of the biggest changes in our legal profession is how artificial intelligence and technology will change everything and the way we do everything.
How do you see that happening?
Oh, it's happening right now, where younger lawyers, much of the work that younger lawyers have historically done, mm-hmm. can now be done by machines.
So what will that bring to the legal profession? What will be the needs of lawyers if artificial intelligence can take over certain roles?
Well, one of the things that we're spending a lot of time focusing on through our ABA Center of Innovation is to use technology to help our citizens narrow the justice gap. Because currently we have 80% of our citizens who are unable to afford a lawyer. So we are hoping to use that technology to assist them, whether through legal apps or other alternative ways of solving their legal problems, where that lack of need for a live lawyer can be turned around to ensure that consumers have access to the legal advice they need.
If there's one thing that the public needs to understand about our legal system, in the last 30 seconds here, what would you tell them?
Support an independent judiciary. It's the fundamental consequence of having a rule of law.
Okay. That is Hillary Bass, who is the president of the American Bar Association. She'll be speaking at the World Affairs Council of Charlotte later today, and we greatly appreciate your time joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins, and this has been Charlotte Talks.